It's a pleasure to welcome Michael Harper to the Poetry Center and to this campus. He is presently teaching at Cal State College in Hayward. He's a graduate of the Writing Workshop at the University of Iowa. He's published everywhere in Poetry Chicago, Poetry Northwest, Southern Review, Negro Digest. And he has a book coming out next year to be called Dear John, Dear Coltrane. Mr. Harper has been a counselor at the Wiltwyck School for Boys in New York, and he's taught at Lewis and Clark and at Reed Colleges in Portland and in California at Los Angeles City College and at Contra Costa College. Mr. Harper has written, and I quote, that he does not speak nor see himself as a black militant, that his commitment to art has required a parallel commitment to pluralism. Until people can have faith in the human concert, the name of the game is survival. He sees black militants and the tendency toward embracing blackness as a primary step toward rediscovering the humanity in black people. Mr. Harper speaks of his own work as a celebration of love in all of its manifestations. It's a great pleasure to give you Michael Harper.
Let me make a comment about the black militancy business, because that's public copy. Things like militancy and radicalism, those are press words. Remember that. Okay, the press needs that to identify people. I got too many poems to read. I can't read them all, but I'll read some and explain the context of their creation and what they mean to me currently. First poem I'm going to read is about a man who is as close to me as anybody. His name is John Stewart, and he's written a novel called Last Cool Days, which will be published in England shortly. And he, in the writing of his novel, captured certain rhythms which were very, very familiar to me. I had them inside of me, and I'd heard them many times. And I decided that because he had made them conscious, I ought to encapsulate them. What this poem is about has nothing to do with what I think many people respond to it as, and I'll comment about that afterwards. This is called Brother John, for John Stewart. Black man. I'm a black man. I'm black. I am. A black man. Black. I'm a black man. I'm a black man. I'm a man. Black. I am. Bird. Buttermilk bird. Smack booze and bitches. I am bird. Baddest night dreamer on sax in the ornithology world. I can fly higher, high, higher. I'm a black man. I'm a black man. I am. I'm a black man. Miles. Blue haze. Miles high. Another bird. More miles. Mute. Mute miles. Clean. Bug-eyed. Unspeakable. Miles. Sweet mute. Sweat miles. Black miles. I'm a black man. I'm black. I am. I'm a black man. Train. Coltrane. John Coltrane. It's train time. Chase the train. It's a slow dance. It's the train in Alabama. Acknowledgement. A love supreme. It's black train. Black. I'm a black man. I am. I'm a black man. I'm a black man. I am. I'm a black man. Brother John. Brother John plays no instrument. He's a black man. Black. He's a black man. He is Brother John. Brother John. I'm a black man. I am. Black. I am. I'm a black man. I am. I am. I'm a black man. I am. I'm a black man. I am. Now, this poem was printed in a newspaper in Portland, Oregon, in the Sunday edition, in an edition entitled Black is Beautiful. And because it wasn't a Sunday issue, lots of people in Portland area saw it, and one woman wrote me a letter. And in writing the letter, she enclosed a poem that she'd written, which had lines like, I'm a white woman. I'm a white woman. I'm white. I'm a white woman. So, see, I had to deal with that, you know, because first of all, and then she began to talk about, you know, her letter, this was a poem, but her letter, which prefaced that, had things like revolution is terrible and blood is terrible, and once you get that thing started, you know, everybody's going to get killed and so on. She had lots of fantasies. It's a very strange thing what language and metaphor will do. But the point about that is that she had misunderstood the poem. And the poem is about style and those who epitomize style. In this case, jazz musicians and the individual who the poem was written for. And it wasn't involved in any funny revolutionary, you know, I didn't say, you know, let's kill them. Kill them. See, because I wasn't in that, you know. It's hard, but, you know, people do project. I mean, that's maybe the strength of the art, but I was offended, see, because she had included her poem. And it's hard, see. Sometimes it's difficult. But I didn't write her either. I mean, I didn't answer because I was afraid of what I might say. So I didn't say anything. I'm going to shift around. I have a long poem here, the entirety of which I'm not going to read, but I'll read sections of it. And I think I'll read that early before I read things which are going to be in the book. This is a very recent poem, and it's called Madimba, M-A-D-I-M-B-A, Gwendolyn Brooks. And it has a kind of invocation which goes, music is your own heartbeat. Double conscious sister in the veil, double conscious sister in the veil, double conscious sister in the veil, double conscious sister in the veil. You beat out the pulse with your mallets, the brown wishbone anemones, unflowered and unworn in Chicago Congo prints, images, otherness, images from the fossil bank. Madimba. Black man. I'm a black man. Black. Aumni padmihun. Another brother gone. The first act of liberation is to destroy one's cage. A love supreme. A love supreme. Images. Words. Language typing the round forms. Juneteenth, baby. We free. Free at last. Black man. I'm a black man. A garden is a man-made vision. Rectangular. Weeded. Shelled. Pathed. Hosed, packed in, covered with manure, pruned. I own you. You're mine. You mine, baby. To bear unborn things. Double conscious sister in the veil. Double conscious sister in the veil. Black woman, America is artful outside time, ideal outside space. You, its only machine, Madimba. Double conscious sister in the veil. I was into some funny things. I'll tell you about that later. Let me get into this long poem. I was in Portland for the year, and it was a very profitable year in terms of poetry because it took me about a year to recover from it. And I mean that very seriously because a lot of personal things went down. and it was profitable because after I left Portland, I was able to deal with lots of things which were going on in my head. And it's very difficult to deal with tragedy and impending tragedy and personal loss and insane people running around asking funny questions, you know, like, Mr. Harvard, what you mean by myth, you know? I think particularly about a student who came to me and said, well, you know, myths are unreal, and you said myth. And I said, look, you got dictionaries, you got books, don't be asking me them funny questions about myths, you know. You got a whole book on it. The point being that there are certain kinds of reality and certain kinds of expressions of reality that people just aren't unwilling to accept. They don't want to deal with, especially when it's coming out of black mouth. You know, and in this case, I was the first black professor there, which is a distinction. I take that as meaningful. Anyway, there's a long poem, which is 20 sections long, and it's called Ruth's Blues, and it's written for my mother-in-law. But it's about much more than my mother-in-law. And I'll read you sections of it. This section is called, and is the first section, is called Blue Ruth, America, History is Your Own Heartbeat. I am telling you this, the tubes in your nose, in the esophagus, in the stomach, the small balloon attached to its end is your bleeding gullet, yellow in the canned sunshine of gauze, stitching bed sores, each tack toe cut sewn back is America. I am telling you this, history is your own heartbeat. The second section is called The Darkly Home Survivors, and there are other sections which I could read to you, but I think it would just take up too much time. So therefore, I'll select various sections that I think might be of interest. This next section I'm going to read is called Love Medley, Patrice Cahoulin. Now, Patrice Cahoulin is my fourth son, my second living son, who in the process of being born stirred up all kinds of archetypal things in my head. And I was there and witnessed his birth. And at the same time he was being born, my mother-in-law was in the process of dying, or so we thought. And I was struck by the ambiguities of my condition. And at the same time, I thought about the beauty of his birth. Stirrups, leggings, a stainless steel slide, a dishpan, sheet, a thread spool, scissors, three face masks, smocks, paper overshoes, a two-way mirror, dials. The head and left arm cruise out, almost together, and you drop into gloves and your own ointment, pulling your legs, binding your cord. The cheesed surface skin, your dark, hairless complexion, the metallic room, orchestrate and blow up your lungs, clogged on protein and vitamins, from the sterile wine of the delivery room and your staff of attendants. It is free exercise when the cord's cut. You weigh in for the cleanup as your mother gets her local for her stitches. Boy, 6 pounds, 13 ounces. As you breathe easily, your mother's mother is tubed and strapped, hemorrhaging slowly from her varices. Your two dead brothers who could not breathe are berries gone to rot at our table. What is birth but death with complexity? Blood, veins, machinery, and love, our names. Then there's another section called Messages, Anesthesia, Blues, 12 to 8. The tubes in my nostrils occasionally itch. An off-red bulbed balloon sits inflated on my stomach in the esophagus. I have not bled near the bulb since Sunday. Their inlets of apparatus, the goggles of white shimmering eggs, evening moss, the haze of abortion, afterbirth to let history die. My surgical nurse has dug her twins in cesarean section, black boy and girl, 1 month premature. Morphine hums these weather clocks, cleaning fluid mopping one cry. The boy dies on an adjacent stretcher. The girl lies there but will not stop breathing. One in a newspaper, the other a blanket, discovered outside to be cleaned in the nursery. An 8-hour shift is a family line. I swim in the southwest corner of the freight elevator, an annulled murderous witness, switching cots over two water-bagged floors. Then the next section is called Witch Wings and Skilled Hands, The Nurse's Song. This man is black, this man is white. This skin is made up of third-degree burns. Lenny is painted in. Why is a black man father of this child? What is his name? We lay in blankets on storage 2x4s with the nails removed. beneath us inflatable mats. I have these pills. I can fly to Seattle. I can marry. I can give up children. Above my breasts, a mobile, a dripping nosebleed, the blood smearing his hairless chest, painting a crack. Two eggs slip on the bannered walls, their yolks blurred like flypaper. The uterus swells in a flowering nest while the Venus twins thicken. This spotted discharge creamery, diet and exercise, whips numb legs up five flights of stairs, auburn curls, corseted, loose gowned. My children rise up as vapor, dice on our picnic table, the matching eyes in hum in brown froth, rhythmic and open as a hang band. The yeasty bump rises with the full moon, white, 8 months pregnant, in the Portland ghetto, fetters and a uniform, all black. The next section is called Clan Meeting, Births and Nations, a Blood Song. We reconstruct lives in the intensive care unit, pieced together in a buffet dinner. Two widows with cancerous breasts in their bald hands. A 30-year-old man in a 3-month coma from a Buick and a brick wall. A woman who bleeds off and on from her gullet. A prominent socialite, our own nurse, shrieking for twins, her bump gone. The gallery of veterans, suckered, awake, without valves, some lungs gone. Splicing the meats with fluids seasoned on the dressing room table, she sings the bump-gone refrain in this 69-degree oven, unstuffing her twin yolks carved from the breast, the dark meat wrapped in tinfoil and clean newspaper. The half-black registered nurse hums her 6 years in an orphanage, her adopted white family, breaded and primed in a posse, rising in clan for their dinner. We reload our brains as the cameras, the film overexposed in the X-ray light, locked with our double-door light meters, race and sex spooled and rung in a hobby. We take our bundle and go home. Next section is called This Is My Son's Song, Ungi Hai Ungi. Now, my oldest son is about 3, almost 3 and a half. And at the time this was going on, he was approaching his third birthday. And his word for his grandmother is Ungi, U-N-G-I-E. A 2-year-old boy is a blossom in the intensive care aisle, small as a ball bearing, round, open, and smooth. For a month in his first premature hours, his shaved head made him a Mohawk Indian child, tubes the herbs from his nest, a collapsed lung the bulbous wing of a hawk. Slivered into each soul is an intravenous solution to balance his losses or what they take out for the lab. The blue spot on his spine is a birthmark of needle readings, the hardened thighs immune from 70 shots of various drugs of an even depth. The chest is thick with congestion, bad air and mucus, good air and pure oxygen, jerky pouch buffalo lungs. It does not surprise me when he waits patiently for his grandmother over her 5-hour painless operation. He has waited in his isolate before. The glow in his eyes is for himself, will and love, an exclamation of your name. Ungi, hi Ungi, you are saved. This section is called History as Bandages, Polka Dots and Moonbeams. And in this case, polka dots and moonbeams refers to a particular rendition played by Bud Powell. One is an igloo of whalebone and oil and a poisonous gas. One is a canoe underwater, laden with wild rice, grubs, and Indian arrows. One is a banjo packed with thin dirt in Richmond, Virginia. Gabriel, 1800. One is a round bubble of mustard rock broken on an Indian squaw. One is a print of a buffalo, bearded, masked, made musty-skinned hair. The white rectangular patchwork covers all of these national wounds, kept secretly bound at night, absorbing color and blood and bones of all shapes and disguises. This is called It Is Here That Coltrane Is. I better make a couple of comments about this because it's so complicated. At the time that I was living in Portland, I was essentially culturally strung out. No jazz, no radio station, no record players. I had my records, but my record player wasn't good enough, really, to play my jams, and I wasn't in any spiritual shape to be listening to Train, because Train was opening up all kinds of avenues which I didn't really want to deal with. But Train was there in my head and in my guts. And what we were talking about is essentially modals, a manner of approaching the world in terms of context and experience. This is called It Is Here That Coltrane Is. Soul and race are private dominions, memories and modal songs, a tenor blossoming which would paint suffering a clear color, but is not in this Victorian house, without oil, in 0-degree weather, and a 40-mile-an-hour wind. It is all a well-knit family, a love supreme. Oak leaves pile up on the walkway and steps, Catholic as apples in a special mist of clear white children who love my children. I play Alabama on a warped record player, skipping the scratches on your face over the fibrous conical hairs of plastic under the wooden floors. Dreaming on a train from New York to Philly, you hand out 6 notes which become an anthem to our memories of you. Oak, birch, maple, apple, cocoa, rubber. For this reason, Martin is dead. For this reason, Malcolm is dead. For this reason, Coltrane is dead. In the eyes of my first son are the browns of these men and their music. Then the last section in this poem is called On the Inside, Vision as Wonder. The inner life is rich with blue rocks chiseled in running water, the minerals and salts intact. We putty out the slick indentures with homemade paste and an oil can. The poems shine through with each buffing as black men X in their missing names, or a buffalo herd stampedes over a butte without sound. We get all this down in ink. What to do about blacks costs billions of dollars. We educate and re-educate ourselves in weaponry and ballistics as the polls come in. In the space for our marks, the pen picks up the count in decimals on the wires. We get all this down in ink. Let me change the tone a little bit, you know. This is, it's into some other stuff, you know. There was an incident. I ought to tell you about this because everybody's got their black studies motif. Let me tell you about the Portland syndrome. This poem is called The Faculty Club, Portland, Oregon. And like all incidents which involve student and faculty, curriculum, and changes of vision, there were lines of demarcation and separation. Everybody got into their particular bags and their factions, and then they blew over cocktails. Now, they had forgotten some very fundamental things about American history. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about American history. The Faculty Club, Portland, Oregon. These are liberals in starched dungarees, the color of shark skin. This is a college senior who hunts seals in the Yukon with a hammer. This is our president, his testes in magnified glass, the color of crystal. Our language is clear, polished, of cast wax, the breathing measured, each in his box seat, honed and ready. Academic freedom, black studies, pup tents on our lawn's meridian, camped and potted in our orchidean garden, freshened with incest manure, humanities, clean funds from directors and the government. The conservatives, the lower division, always against war, negotiate our flints, feathered gowns, tenure, genteel wines, and this song. As you can tell, I was warm to those people. Because they're playing games with people's lives, you know. They're having an exercise in purient schizophrenia. And I wasn't playing. You might have been checking out the various political things which happened in the country. And last year, Wayne Morris was unseated, and I have a friend of mine in Portland who was very instrumental in the Morris recount, a man named John Callahan. And with his enthusiasm and verve, he involved me in the recount proceedings. And the recount proceedings are some jive shit. I mean, really. Because you begin to find out what Americans are really about, you know. Now, let me explain the graphics. What you have is a table like this, and you have an individual here who's generally a Republican, an individual catty-corner from him who's a Democrat, and you have the opposing factors over the shoulder while they count the votes. And then you have two people who are tallying, and you have an official caller. Well, it's a very strange thing that happened. First of all, it's a long, arduous process, and in the proceedings, you know, one gets very bleary-eyed, and you begin to get involved in psychological games. And these games have something to do with terror. You begin to try to intimidate the individual you're dealing with. And of course, me, the only black cat with a beret, dark glasses, and Levi's and all that, I became the walking manifestation of King Kong, you see. Now, as a result of this, there were some very strange things that happened because nobody wanted to deal with me, and they used to switch me from table to table. This is what we call intimidation. And I'm the only brother, see, so, I mean, I'm the one. Get him, you know. And, of course, I enjoyed it for a while because I was getting my poetry together. But then this shit got dull, see. I mean, you know, because you stand up 8 hours a day, man, your feet hurt and your legs ache and you're looking at some jive people and they're going through them genteel things. You know, they hate you and they want to kill you, but they ain't saying that. And I'm dealing with people who I don't really respect, but we're in the same camp. Like, I ain't a Democrat, you know, but I'm out there out of a personal commitment to a friend of mine. So there I am. And in the process, these various things took place and they kept bombarding my head. You know, I'm writing a poem and they think I'm challenging. You know, very funny shit. Anyway. This is called the Morse Recount, History as Bridge, a Convention. There are 13 bingo tables, an arcade of hairsprays floating in an Oregon barn burning, cameras taping challengers, recorders, the droplets of rain which, in dust, settle like feet on high wires, bodies cloaked to attention, fingered into poses of mourning, war, hunger, ghetto Kong, drugs, the congressional mafia. We count in triplicate, striking the no votes as ushers at the World Series. Nothing at stake but our buttons, callousing our high-tension feet. The game lost, the urge to piss on our cards on the auction table. The process of government is ritual. Darts, blowgun, a soup pot, twigs, herbs, warriors in ascending order, the poisonous meat. Beginning to eat, we nourish our cooked lottery with blood sacrifice on our counting table. Maybe I better get into the book and read some things from the book. This is called Black Study. No parenthetical remarks really necessary. No one's been told that black men went first to the moon, the dark side, for darker brothers, without spaceship gravity complex in our computer centers, government campuses, instant play and replay, white mice and pig guineas in concentric digital rows. Someone has been pulling brothers' curls into fancy barbed wire, measuring his forelegs, caressing his dense innards into formaldehyde, pruning the jellied marrow. A certain formula is appearing. Someone has been studying you. Then there's a sequence of poems about my family, which I think I'll read. Let me read this first. This is called American History, and I better tell you about the context because it's important. This poem is some years old now. I was once a graduate student and was in an interdisciplinary seminar, which means it was composed of people from various departments in a graduate seminar, supposedly to have a meeting of the minds. And in the process, we had people involved in history and political science, anthropology and physics and English and so on. And the topic of this particular lecture was American history. And this was Birmingham, 1963. And I was listening to the rhetoric. I was listening to the various citation of events and the pomposity of the rhetoric, and I finally just was bugged so much I decided I just had to do something. So I wrote a poem. That's how people do things. They work with their conflict by writing poems. And at this time I had no sense that it was anything more than that. I put it away and forgot it. American history. Those four black girls blown up in that Alabama church remind me of 500 Middle Passage blacks in a net underwater in Charleston Harbor so redcoats wouldn't find them. Can't find what you can't see, can you? The next group of poems are a series. There are four poems, and I won't pause between them. The first one is written at the death of my second son, and the second one is written right soon after that about the same event. The third poem is called Death Watch and is in three parts. The first part for my wife, the second for a passing third son, and a third for my country. And then the fourth section is a poem I wrote in Portland when we were expecting my fourth son. And the tones vary a good deal. They're not in any way similar, and they're not meant to be considered in sequence except in terms of the events which propel the poems. We assume, on the death of our son, Reuben Masai Harper. We assume that in 28 hours lived in a collapsible isolate, you learn to accept pure oxygen as the natural sky. The scant, shallow breaths that filled those hours cannot, did not make you fly, but dreams were there, like crooked palm prints on the twin thick windows of the nursery in the glands of your mother. We assume the sterile hands drank chemicals in and out from lungs opaque with mucus, pumped your stomach, eked the bicarbonate in crooked green-winged veins out in a plastic mask. A woman who'd lost her first son consoled us with an angel gone ahead to pray for our family. Gone into that sky seeking oxygen. Gone into autopsy. A fine brown powdered sugar. A disposable cremation. We assume you did not know we loved you. Second poem is called Reuben Reuben. I reach from pain to music, great enough to bring me back. Swollen head, madness, love fruit, a pickle of hate so sour my mouth twicked up and would not sing. There's nothing in the beat to hold it in melody and turn human skin. A brown berry gone to rot just 2 days on the branch. We've lost a son. The music, jazz, comes in. Third poem is called Death Watch. Twitching in the cactus hospital gown, a loon on hairpin wings, she tells me how her episiotomy is perfectly sewn and doesn't hurt while she sits in a pile of blood which once cleaned the placenta my third son should be in. She tells me how early he is and how strong, like his father, and long, like a black-stemmed Easter rose in a white hand. Just under 5 pounds, you lie there, a collapsed balloon doll, burst in your 15th hour, with the face of your black father, his fingers, his toes, and 8 voodoo adrenaline holes in your pinwheeled, hairline chest. You witness your parents sign the autopsy and disposal papers, shrunk into duplicate, and black ink on white paper, like the country you were born in, unreal, asleep, silent, almost alive. This is a dedication to our memory of 3 sons, 2 dead, 1 alive, a reminder of a letter to Du Bois from a student at Cornell on behalf of his whole history class. The class is confronted with a question, and no one, not even the professor, is sure of the answer. Will you please tell us whether or not it is true that Negroes are not able to cry? America needs a killing. America needs a killing. Survivors will be human. And then later in Portland, different situation, different kinds of things propelling me. I wrote a poem called Another Season for Cheryl. She tells me she feels flutters for the fourth time in 3 years. Rain and wind scuff 4 inches of leaves to a porch full of toys. Our first sons. Another and another season come on. And a child climbs up her womb towards her belly. I've written poems intentionally to wash off Reuben, Michael, gone on. Now I write this poem, early, feeling the movement in the belly go on. Let me read some other things. Let me read some kind of humorous things. These are three poems put together, and they're about schizophrenia, and also about Br'er Rabbit and culture, and how black people respond to it. This is called Proposition 15. Now, some of you might have been alive when Proposition 14 went down. And this has got nothing to do with Proposition 14. This is the next proposition called Proposition 15. Christmas Eve and no presents. The snow's in the mountains. The fat saint hasn't gotten his witless teamwork from ski trails and mushroom mountaintops. The lake water is truly sky blue. Everybody's waiting for dark. The minstrels take the lawns to attract the sky flies coming at night in flight. Red-suited saint with his whip and his sack full of toys. It can't be Halloween. My backyard is covered with snow. 8 rabbits in rain settle their cottontail feet in the molasses earth and begin their whimsical dancing, a figure-eight cycle of rhythm and blues. I see rose-thorn tambourines. See that green honey-dewed fruit. See the white sheets and pillowcases. See that gray-haired black storyteller on the porch swing. Even you are a believer. Now, green honeydew fruit is watermelon, and that particular black storyteller is Uncle Remus, and this perhaps is the tale he's telling. This is called Molasses and the Three Witches. Inside Out, the police announce there's a riot on CBS. It's a barn fire. Firemen and police ball-eye into the squares. This is the first barn fire in history. Roll'em. Lady says she saw the first keg of molasses in a gunny sack on a huge black's back, a black rose bush on his big-eared helper. Flour and grits in a pelt as soft as snow, all gone up in the smoke of the last spiritual of Br'er's bear, rabbit, fox, the black trinity. I will not go quietly. I will not go quietly. I will not go quietly. Then there was a program on Channel 9 called Aftermath, where 4 people, 2 black, 2 white, got together and chatted over the racial scene in order to get understanding. You sometimes might have checked that out. There was one particular program where a man named Price Cobbs, a psychiatrist, was rapping with 3 other people. And this was the poem that came out of it. Aftermath. Blacks all dead in the streets. The guerrillas run white sympathizers in out of the hills. The city streets are brush fires of the last lovely battle. There were those who did not believe, on both sides, in the fury of those last night's human fires. Ready-made armies hunt even the freeways. Now the flames suck kerosene human flesh as the hostages loom, military twigs in this medicinal barbecue. The country, finally, is white with snow. Let me read the title poem of my book, Dear John, Dear Coltrane. There's a section in this poem where there's a question-retort symbolic of the workings of the black church in the heightening of emotion and release given the ceremony of real religion, you know, which is human. Dear John, dear Coltrane, a love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme. Sex, fingers, toes, in the marketplace, near your father's church in Hamlet, North Carolina. Witness to this love in this calm fallow of these minds. There is no substitute for pain. Genitals gone or going, seed burned out. You tuck the roots in the earth, turn back and move by river through the swamp, singing, a love supreme, a love supreme. What does it all mean? Loss, so great each black woman expects your failure in mute change, the seed gone. You plod up into the electric city, your songs now crystal and the blues. You pick up the horn with some will and blow into the freezing night. A love supreme, a love supreme. Dawn comes, and you cook up the thick sin between impotence and death. Fuel the tenor sax's cannibal heart, genitals and sweat that makes you clean. A love supreme, a love supreme. Why you so black? 'Cause I am. Why you so funky? 'Cause I am. Why you so black? 'Cause I am. Why you so sweet? 'Cause I am. Why you so black? 'Cause I am. A love supreme, a love supreme. So sick you couldn't play Naima. So flat we ached for songs you'd concealed with your own blood. Your diseased liver gave out its purity. The inflated heart pumps out the tenor kiss, tenor love. A love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme. These next poems, man, are gonna be into some other stuff, but I better go on and read them. This is called A Mother Speaks, The Algiers Motel Incident, Detroit. Now, some of you might not know about the Algiers Motel Incident, but that took place in 1967 during the summer in Detroit. And a man named John Hersey wrote a book called The Algiers Motel Incident. And he has a section in that book called A Mother Speaks. This is not to do with that particular section, but it does suggest certain kinds of overtones. It's too dark to see black in the windows of Woodward or Virginia Park. The undertaker pushes his body black into place with plastic and gum, but it wouldn't hold water. When I looked for marks or lineament or fine stitching, I was led away without seeing this plastic face they built that was not my son's. They tied the eye torn out by shotgun into place, and his shattered arm cut away with his buttocks that remained. My son's gone by white hands, though he said to his last word, oh, I'm so sorry, officer, I broke your gun. Then there's a beautiful, beautiful musician named Paul Lawrence Dunbar Chambers, who at 33 died. I call this poem Mr. PC. John Coltrane wrote a song once called Mr. PC for Paul Chambers. Paul Lawrence Dunbar Chambers, what a long history of perfection, bass man. Those swollen solos on Miles' standard teachings. Blues. Dun, 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 dun. If Mingus is monster star, you are his private brother. So soft, baby, so beauteous in your shuffling. How many soundful dyspexia did you do it over and over and over? Doing it to everybody's gut strings, listening as flat out gem as harp, heart, and bone. What a long history, Paul Lawrence Dunbar Chambers, and your namesakes in the chambers. Two more. One is called Dead Day for Malcolm. Dead Day, Malcolm, February 21. This was written on the fifth anniversary of his death. A couple of explanations. Number one, Malcolm X had a Playboy interview. And after the interview, he sent the editors of Playboy a postcard. And on the back of the postcard was a rattlesnake on the back of it. And that is a reference to his famous postcard. And then also, more recently, around Christmas time, there are Christmas cards with Malcolm in Santa Claus outfit on the cover. And you open the cover, and there's a little statement, happiness by any means necessary. Dead Day, Malcolm, February 21. The pit vipers are asleep, having wreathed through each bullet hole memory cued by the new religion. We are now a black establishment in our love for you. It is astonishing how 4 years gashed wider chasms in our story, in our Mayflower, and your famous postcard to Playboy, Christmas card to follow, happiness by any means necessary. We've placed some Malcolm-esque soul brothers near the soul kits. Who walks the schizophrenic line? What is terror but a black orchid, a white lightning bouquet? St. Malcolm at the Oracle. A omni pod me hum, another brother gone. Ode to Tenochtitlan for Tommy Smith and John Carlos. Socks and gloves, the medal of honor, ablaze in twin fists of two black men, blackened in the imperial fires. They stand before Coltrane in their beauty, the new emblem, another brother gone. A style so resilient and chromatic, the pure reeds of their bodies bulge through metric distances in their special rhythms. The impossible bowels of round forms digest the air of the television cameras in a new vision now on Olympus. Moon children? Gemini? The black stopwatch? We have heard the cries bend the index, the word form plumed black, the traditional images. Who can understand having thought life was somehow transmuted and cleansed, transistored into a machine? In the heats, in the instant replays, amidst the circuits of brain waves come back into rhythm with a fisted victory in another game, a new current, a new exchange, a new vision. As a twin black spirit, brothers come on home. Then a last one called Biafra Blues. I had a student at Contra Costa named Odenachi Nwosu, who was a Biafran. Mr. Nwosu was going through some changes because his people were undergoing some classic changes. Biafra Blues. Another brother gone, 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 another brother gone. Gray hair and puffed bellies, the stomach moves out to its specialty. Floating children first without smiles. The Soviet Union lays it out on the consumers starving in the oil-slick whites of their eyes. The Red Cross bandages the refugee camps in a white blockade. Another brother gone, 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 another brother gone. Egyptian pilots cash the American checks. Lagos, Old England, Washington are animal kingdoms in the guts of the war. There is no war, that's not famine, members of the UN. Biafra is an eastern community in revolt across territorial lines worked out with a European compass. Fathom the sectioning off, Biafra. There is no famine, there is no genocide, only a community in revolt, only the refinement of oil slicks, only a black smell sunken aglow. Another brother gone, 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 another brother gone. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Mr. Harper for a vivid and arresting reading, and I would like to invite you all to a coffee hour at Ecumenical House immediately following the reading. And I'd like also to remind you that Nanano Sakaki and Gary Snyder will be reading here a week from today at 2 o'clock. Thanks.